I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, why Trump's carrier deal isn't the way to save U.S. jobs. Our guest, Ben Castleman, is from 538 and writes In Real Terms, a regular column analyzing the latest economic news. He says that the direct economic impact of the deal with Carrier, which is a manufacturer of air conditioners and furnaces, is clearly a sideshow, symbolically important, representing a campaign promise kept, or at least partly kept, since Carrier still plans to outsource hundreds of other jobs to Mexico, may provide this whole deal some hints about how Trump plans to approach economic policy as president. He will approach governing much as he approached business as a deal maker. Good for grabbing headlines, but will it do much to address the underlying forces that are eroding blue-collar jobs? This hour, we'll also talk about what's eroding those jobs, what can be done about that, why Carrier made the decision that they did, the threats of penalties for companies that outsource jobs, the arguments, and he says they're strong, for reforming the corporate tax system, and the list goes on. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ben. Ben is senior editor and the chief economics writer for 538. He's an adjunct lecturer at the City University of New York in the school's journalism department, previously a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and he joined us last in May to talk about how manufacturing jobs are just not coming back. So we can ask that again, and we'll replace them. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Ben. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. You start your article in 538 talking about, and let's spend a moment on this, the U.S. gaining 178,000 jobs in the month of November, but what we concentrated on were those carrier jobs. What kinds of jobs did we create in November?
Yeah, I mean, so we've had a pretty remarkable run of job growth, you know, going back several years now. And, you know, we've added jobs consistently, you know, month after month, pretty steady job growth, you know, not sort of spectacular runaway growth, but really pretty strong. And, you know, those jobs have been across the board. You know, I hear a lot when I talk to people about worries that these are part-time jobs, that they're low-wage jobs. And that may have been true kind of early in the economic recovery. But what we've been seeing recently is pretty solid across-the-board job growth. Manufacturing has been a little weak recently, but it's been strong over the recovery as a whole. Oil and gas jobs, of course, have been struggling with low oil prices, you know, but they had a big run-up for a while there. Construction is starting to come back. So we're seeing, you know, a pretty good across-the-board range of job growth, although obviously, you know, there's some variation by region, and, you know, not every part of the country is seeing the same kind of strength.
Mm-hmm. And yet it is true, what we concentrated on were those carrier jobs and a deal that was made to keep not 1,000 of them, but what was it, 850 or something like that?
Depending on how you count them, yeah.
Yeah, from going to Mexico. Why do we concentrate so much on that?
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of reasons. You know, the best reason to focus on those jobs is, look, these are good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
The carrier jobs were, you know, paid, you know, $20 to $30 an hour. You know, they were good, steady work. You know, I think I spoke the last time I was on the show talking about, you know, that a lot of the reason that we tend to romanticize manufacturing jobs is they've historically been good jobs. They've often been union jobs. They offer, you know, benefits and some security. And so there's every reason to care deeply about saving those jobs. The other reason, of course, that we talked about the carrier jobs, and I think this is sort of the more pernicious piece of this, is that it was this sort of very headline-grabbing thing from Donald Trump and Mike Pence. And, you know, I think the concern there, and we can get into this in some more depth, but is that if you're a company that kind of catches the attention of President-elect Trump, you know, he can you know, cause a lot of trouble, and he can find ways to make you stick around by carrot or by stick. But at the same time, we're constantly losing and creating jobs in this economy. And it's not clear that the best way to encourage job creation is to sort of have companies live in fear that if they kind of get caught, they're going to be in trouble. But if they can somehow stay under the radar, that nobody's going to notice them.
Mm-hmm. So how many jobs these days are deciding that they have to move to Mexico or to China because labor costs are so much cheaper there? Are we going to see a whole string of companies that are going to ask for help from the Donald Trump administration to keep them from going to Mexico? And how would the administration respond to which ones they're going to do something for and which ones they're not?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. The biggest wave of outsourcing is probably actually behind us at this point.
Really?
It's sort of interesting that it got so much attention during this last campaign. You know, we've seen a huge wave of outsourcing to Mexico and even more so to China, over the last 15 years. But a lot of those jobs have gone at this point, right? I mean, it's not – the garment industry is long since gone. A lot of the sort of basic manufacturing is long since gone. It's continuing to happen, of course. But we've already seen a slowdown in outsourcing, partly because a lot of those jobs have left and partly because labor costs in Mexico are rising, labor costs in China to a somewhat lesser degree are rising. And, of course, what we've had is this parallel trend of automation, which means that it's actually cheaper to produce a lot of goods now in the U.S. because you don't need to employ so many people. So in some cases, what we're seeing here are lost jobs not due to outsourcing, but due to automation. I think you raise a really important point here, though, which is the incentives that a deal like this gives to other companies, which is that if you realize that, you say, oh, I'm going to outsource jobs to Mexico, that you can get a big tax break, that gives every incentive to start saying, oh, well, I'm thinking about moving some jobs to Mexico. How about some tax breaks for me? We've seen this at a local and state level for years, right, where Indiana fights with Illinois over who can have a lower tax rate and keep a company there. If we start to see that on an international level, we're just going to see companies sort of fighting to see who can get the best incentive.
Mm-hmm. What about Donald Trump's threats of penalties for companies that do outsource jobs? He's talked about this 35% tariff for those companies. Is this going to be a reality, and what would this do for jobs and for corporations?
Yeah, I mean, so to some extent, I think we don't know, right? Donald Trump ran a campaign that really featured very little in the way of very specific policy proposals, and often when he did make specific policy proposals, he offered contradictory proposals at different points. I think that we can read the tea leaves a little bit here by who he's appointed to his cabinet and some of the other things that he's said. And my sense from those tea leaves is that a sort of hard tariff is relatively unlikely. If you look at the people that he's appointed to his cabinet so far, Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, these are people who are kind of involved in international trade and finance. They tend to be people who are very much, globalists and free traders. And I think the notion that he's going to impose real tariffs is relatively unlikely. I think we're more likely to see the kind of thing that we saw with Carrier, where kind of a company becomes a symbol and he makes a big deal of that.
Mm-hmm.
If he did impose that tariff, you have a couple of real problems. You have some practical questions, right? How are you going to define outsourcing? How do you distinguish that from a company that's expanding overseas? How do you distinguish that from a company that might find a way to produce one part more cheaply overseas, but that allows them to expand more production in the U.S. because now they're more profitable? There are a lot of sort of detailed pieces of this. And then you also have a question of retaliation. We are members of the World Trade Organization. As a requirement of that, we have to keep tariffs low. If we raise them, then other countries can impose their own tariffs, and that can hurt our exporters. And we have a lot of companies here that manufacture in the U.S., but that use parts from overseas, that manufacture across borders. And it's not clear that even many U.S. manufacturers would benefit from the kind of tariffs that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. You cite in your recent article that his economic team, the advisors are really, really rich. The cabinet people are really, really rich. I think he's made reference to the fact that he wants people who have been wildly successful and have made a lot of money because they'll know what they're doing. You also cite that very few of these people have any kind of policy background. Is that important?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. We have, Republican candidates for years have said that they want to bring more private sector experience into government. And Trump is certainly doing that, probably more so than anybody previously. You know, I think that it's probably worth distinguishing a little bit between, you know, some of the different people in his cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
Rex Tillerson, his Secretary of State nominee, has no sort of formal diplomatic experience, but he has done lots of things in his career that are relevant to running an agency like the State Department, right? He has negotiated with foreign leaders, obviously famously Vladimir Putin, which is something that you know, has made him controversial. He has run a very large organization, you know, one of the few organizations that, you know, can kind of credibly be compared to a government. There are plenty of reasons to potentially oppose Rex Tillerson's nomination, but he has experience that is pretty clearly relevant. You look at somebody like Ben Carson, who he's nominated to run to HUD, Housing and Urban Development. You know, he's somebody who not only doesn't have government experience, but kind of has no obviously relevant experience in housing, right? It's different than if he had been nominated to be Surgeon General or to, you know, maybe run Health and Human Services. So I think that it's sort of worth thinking about those separately. But, you know, there's a lot of blocking and tackling in government. There's a lot of how do you go about writing a law? How do you go about writing a regulation and putting that into place? That doesn't necessarily all have to come from the person who, you know, holds the title of secretary. And so I'll be interested to see what happens as he starts filling out undersecretary positions and deputy undersecretary positions. But if you don't have many people who know how the kind of ins and outs of government work, sometimes that can actually end up with more influence from lobbyists, from special interests, right? Because you have to sort of turn to them to do some of the nitty-gritty work that you don't have the experience to
mm-hmm.
do.
He obviously won the election in large measure because people who have been hurting so much as a result of the recession and manufacturing jobs disappearing and outsourcing and automation taking a huge toll on their lives. And you say that's happening particularly in parts of the country that voted strongly for Donald Trump. So he's going to have to come up with some kind of plan to replace the jobs that were lost. And there were millions of those jobs, and he has millions of people who are counting on him and really feel as though they voted for him because he gave them hope that they would be able to make a good living again. How can he do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, that all of that's absolutely right. And the concerns that people in the Midwest and in other places had that led to them supporting Trump, I think are in many cases, you know, very, very understandable. It is a real thing that manufacturing jobs have been lost. It is a real thing that, the jobs that used to pay $25 an hour are paying $15 an hour, or sometimes less than that. And so thinking about what we can do to help those parts of the country, to help workers who, you know, now don't have the kind of prospects that they once might have, you know, those are real challenges that deserve to be taken on. One thing that I sort of criticized Trump for during the campaign, and I think is going to be a key question in his administration, is do you promise to do something that is impossible? Do you promise to bring back sort of lost days of manufacturing? Or do you think seriously about what can replace those jobs? You know, there's nothing inherently magical about manufacturing. Right. The reason, as I said before, mm-hmm. that we sort of romanticize manufacturing is that these were good-paying jobs for people without college degrees. Those jobs exist outside of manufacturing. There are jobs in the medical profession, for example, that require less than a college degree that pay well. There are jobs in construction still that fall into that category. The question is, how do you ensure that more of those service sector jobs, more of those non-manufacturing jobs, kind of achieve the goal that manufacturing used to achieve. And I'd rather see more focus on that question rather than on sort of some realistically unfulfillable promise of bringing back lost manufacturing jobs.
And do you, when we were talking about cabinet positions and other appointments, do you see anybody who has the vision to do what you just described, who he has nominated to be an advisor, to be a cabinet member?
You know, I think Wilbur Ross is somebody who has gotten some credit from workers in the past. You know, this is a guy in finance who, you know, bought up small companies or you know, bought up struggling companies. And, you know, that's an industry that often gets pretty easily sort of tarred with a negative brush. But actually a lot of workers at some of those companies have spoken up and said that, you know, he probably saved a lot of jobs by making those companies solvent again. Whether he can do that on an economy-wide scale, I think, is very much an open question. But he has received some praise there. You know, the team that Trump has put together on the sort of economic side is not necessarily a dogmatic one. Right? We actually don't know very much about what Steve Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary, what his ideology is. He hasn't necessarily named people to some of his sort of core economic advisory positions. So, you know, I think if you want to be optimistic about it, you can sort of say some of these people are pragmatists who, you know, have looked for ways to work in the private sector in the past. I think if you want to be more pessimistic about it, you can say none of these are people who have tackled these problems certainly, you know, from a governmental position in the past, and you know, there's not necessarily much reason to think they're going to be able to here.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll have many of them coming in now, I'm sure, Ben. Ben Castleman is our guest this hour. Ben has been with us before. He's senior editor and chief economics writer for 538, adjunct lecturer at the City University of New York. He was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and he's written a lot, but the article we're concentrating on today is why Trump's carrier deal isn't the way to save jobs, and it's part of a regular column in Real Terms, in which he does very interesting and important analysis of economic news. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I guess the question of the hour is, what can replace the stable jobs that were family-supporting jobs? Millions of people lost those jobs when manufacturing left. What can replace them? And do you think that Donald Trump has given us a vision of what can replace them so that people can make some money? We'll go to you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. All right, to phone calls, we go to Dave in Madison first. Hello, Dave.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I hope that no one is giving Donald Trump any credit for the recent rise in the economy, because you shouldn't measure a president's effect until he passes his first budget. Wouldn't it be fair to say Obama's economic impact was from when he passed his first budget until Donald Trump passes his first budget, and the same with Obama's predecessor? His effect, Bush's effect, lasted until Obama passed his first budget.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I would actually take it maybe further than that and say that most of the impact that presidents have on the economy is really over the long term. You know, with the exception of maybe some of what was done in the middle of the recession by both Presidents Bush and President Obama to try to kind of juice the economy and try to save it during the recession. Outside of periods like that, presidents really don't have much control over, you know, the unemployment rate this month or wages this month or inflation this month. To the extent that they influence the economy is by things like infrastructure spending, things like education policy over the truly long term, you know, certainly over things like regulation for good and for ill. And those are things that take years to play out. I mean, I think in many cases we probably won't know Obama's true economic legacy for, you know, until several years into the Trump administration. You know, there are things that you can do to mess up the economy in the short term, and there are things that you can do to rescue it during a recession. But I wouldn't start judging Trump's economic impact until we're well into his term.
Mm. What's going on with the stock market, which seems to be doing very, very well since Donald Trump won the election?
Yeah, I mean, so it's been fascinating. There was an expectation from a lot of people that the stock market would actually crash in the case of a Trump election. There had been some signals in the weeks leading up to the election that kind of every time Clinton seemed to do well and to be assured of winning, then stocks rose, and every time she sort of stumbled, then stocks fell. I think that was, and I argued this at the time, that was a sort of simplistic reading of things. I think that there were a lot of investors who were nervous about the uncertainty of if there might be a recount or if somebody might challenge the results of the election. And so there was a bit of a sigh of relief that there was a clear result, whether or not it was the one that investors necessarily wanted. You know, there are a lot of Trump's policies that are probably good for corporate profits. You know, it's worth remembering here that the stock market doesn't judge the economy. The stock market judges what investors think companies will make. And in the short term, some of the things that Trump has talked about, cutting the corporate tax rate, cutting regulation, investing in infrastructure, these are things that may or may not be good for the economy, but that are good for corporate profits in the short term and therefore good for the stock market. Over the longer term, if we have big deficits, if we have greater inequality and that creates social unrest or that creates other economic issues, you know, a lot of those policies may not be good for the economy or for the average worker. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad for the stock market, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm. You say that there are strong arguments for reforming the corporate tax system. What are they?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know almost any economist on the left or the right who thinks that the corporate tax system that the U.S. has right now makes a whole lot of sense. We have what's a relatively quite high not corporate tax rate in theory if you compare it to other developed nations. But then we have tons and tons of loopholes that make it easy for big companies with sophisticated accountants to find ways to pay much less in taxes. And meanwhile, you have small businesses that don't have all of those advantages who end up paying high corporate tax rates. Some of the intricacies, and I won't bore your listeners with sort of too much of the ins and outs of this, but some of the intricacies about the way we tax overseas profits makes it disincentivizes companies from bringing profits back here and investing them in the U.S. There are different arguments for the right way to fix that system, but I think most economists, again, kind of regardless of where they stand on the ideological spectrum, would argue that some sort of system that no longer lets big companies off the hook, that lowers taxes for smaller corporations, some balance in there probably makes a lot of sense.
We go next to Peter in Madison. Hi, Peter.
Yeah. Justin Trudeau in Canada talks about export jobs paying 50% more than jobs that are oriented to their domestic market. Why don't we talk about export jobs in those terms here in the U.S.? Is it because our mix of jobs is different, or is it because we're missing something?
Yeah, it's a good question. We have, jobs making things, you know, Caterpillar, for example, that makes, you know, big equipment that gets shipped overseas, those jobs often pay very well, whereas, you know, some of the manufacturing that's made for the domestic market are pretty low-paying jobs. I think that to the extent that there is a need to improve U.S. trade policy, one, you know, real question there is how do you make it easier for U.S. manufacturers to sell overseas? How do you make sure that China plays by the rules so that we can sell goods there? The other thing that often gets relatively little attention is the export of services as well as goods. This gets into some sort of tricky economic accounting, but a lot of engineering, a lot of architecture, a lot of research that gets done in the U.S. and then sold overseas, those are very well-paying jobs in the U.S., and those are jobs, services that, help the overall economy. We rarely talk about that. It can get kind of tricky to think about what it means to export a service. But that's a place where the global economy really works to the U.S.'s advantage, and we have a large surplus, a trade surplus, when it comes to the export of services.
Thanks, Peter, for your call. John in Middleton. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Hi, John.
Hi. My observation will reduce the deficit and increase spending. Very first thing is the government should declare all pennies and nickels are worth 10 cents each, so we never have to mint them again. Plus, you can't buy anything for a penny anyway. That'll turn every cookie jar and every piggy bank into a sellable asset and create a surge in spending, especially among low-income groups who are more likely to have the cookie jars.
I got one of those cookie jars, John. How about you?
I always have a change bottle.
Absolutely.
And those pennies could be worth 10 cents each. Do it on very short notice. Only let the program last for 2 years, after which they're no longer legal tender.
Ben, can we do that?
Well, you know, there have been sort of serious suggestions kind of over the long term that eliminating cash completely, not just declaring all pennies to be worth 10 cents, but sort of eventually moving towards a cashless economy actually has some benefits to it. It's the kind of thing that's probably not going to happen anytime soon, but it would give the Federal Reserve, make it easier for them to influence the economy. There are a lot of people who are a little suspicious of the idea of the Federal Reserve having more influence than they already do, but there are some sort of technical reasons why they are a little bit hamstrung by the existence of cash, because if interest rates gets too low, you can just sort of start holding on to cash and stuffing it in the mattress. So I think we could at some point see a day where there's no cash whatsoever, though obviously we're a ways away from that.
Hmm. Kenneth called in and said that Ross Perot warned us of the giant sucking sound of jobs draining out of the U.S. when warning us about NAFTA. Why didn't Democrats and others pay attention to this nearly a decade ago?
Yeah, I mean, so it's interesting. Most of the economic research has really suggested that NAFTA was not the big sucking sound that Ross Perot warned of. We're aware of every time a company moves jobs to Mexico, right? It gets local headlines. In the case of Carrier, it got national headlines. What we sort of don't see as readily are the jobs that get added because of that trade. Whether that's because we have lower prices for goods, which then allows people to spend more and which ultimately creates jobs, or whether that's the goods that we sell to Mexico. In some cases, goods we sell to Mexico, we sell it a piece of equipment to Mexico that allows them to make goods that they then sell back to us. There is research that the real impact is not so much Mexico, but China. China, in part because of its sheer size and in part because they didn't always play by the free trade rules that we set up through agreements like NAFTA, there's a lot of evidence that did create, much larger ripple effects in the U.S. economy. And I think it's important to sort of recognize here that there are benefits to trade, but those benefits don't hit everybody. And, economists have sort of for years and years said, oh, trade is good. It benefits, most people. And to the extent that there are people who lose out, those are relatively short-lived problems and kind of they can readjust. And economists have really started to revisit that over the last few years. And there's a lot of evidence that the adjustments are harder to make. And so, yes, the sort of net benefits for the country as a whole of trade are still there. But if you're in a town that loses its factory, you may not recover. Your children may not recover. And I think that's forcing a lot of people to reevaluate the benefits of trade that obviously had big political implications this year. And I think there's a little bit there of workers kind of saying, what took you so long to figure this out? This is something we've been saying for a long time, and economists are only just starting to catch up on.
Mm-hmm. Could we spend just a moment before we go back to phone calls talking about regulations? Because we're hearing, and we've heard, those of us who do talk shows, for years and years, about how businesses are so overregulated. Donald Trump has talked about reducing regulation. You write about this, and I'm wondering what everybody means by regulations. Are there a lot of onerous regulations that make it very difficult and very expensive for businesses to do business? Are there regulations that need to be dropped? Are they important? Why does everybody talk about it so much?
It's a question that I have often asked myself, and I think it's interesting. People talk about regulation, and then you start to sort of pin them down on it, and it often becomes a little bit trickier. Look, there are definitely regulations that are difficult on specific industries. Environmental regulations have had real impacts in, to the coal power industry, for example. It's not the only thing that has hurt coal, but it is certainly a factor. Whether you think that trade-off is worth it because of global warming, because, in a past generation, because of acid rain, is another question. Mm-hmm. But there are clearly implications for companies when they have to, spend money or in some cases shut down plants because it's going to cost too much to upgrade them. But I think in a lot of cases, it's a lot harder to draw a clear line between regulation and troubles at the business level. Certainly, there are individual companies that will point to a specific regulation that's a problem for them. But I've known researchers who have sort of gone looking very hard for evidence that federal regulations are holding back entrepreneurs or holding back companies from expanding. In some cases, these are economists who ideologically would expect to see that and would like to see that, and they haven't found much evidence. I think one other distinction to make, though, is federal versus state and local. Mm. A lot of the regulations that are most significant for companies are not federal regulations. They're not from the EPA. They're not from the Department of Labor. They're from state and in some cases, municipal regulators, right? This is, if you think about how difficult it can be to build a new development in many cities because of neighborhood opposition, because of zoning codes, or how difficult it can be to get licensed to get a liquor license or to get licensed to practice certain professions. I think those are really the kinds of regulations that often can be the most onerous. But that's not something that happens at a federal level. That's something that happens at the state and local level.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, John, for your call. John in West Dallas, hi.
Well, we have absolutely been devastated by a series of presidents in the labor movement, starting with Lyndon Johnson and going forward, including Mr. Obama, who failed to get the Employee Free Choice Act passed during his administration. That was the second big piece of legislation after Obamacare that he promised America in 2008. And we have a situation here. Until we get every single manufacturing job back that we lost from 1963 until the present, and that includes the Studebaker plant in South Bend, Indiana, these 55 million jobs just vanished. And we are angry. We're organized. We are going to be in Washington from the 15th to the 21st, starting with picketing in front of Meet the Press on Nebraska Avenue in Washington, D.C., going to the caucus room where Mr. Boehner had his famous dinner. We're going to have a dinner there and challenge Mr. Trump just as Mr. Boehner challenged Mr. Obama, and a huge counter rally to stop the inauguration of Donald Trump on the 20th of January. We are organized, and don't take us for granted. Don't ignore us anymore, as you have done.
As who has done?
You, for one.
Oh, come on. We talk about these issues all the time. What do you think? Labor, how organized is labor? Ben?
Well, so I think we have seen something of a resurgence in the labor movement over the last few years that's manifested itself in the Fight for 15 movement, the minimum wage movement across the country. I think a lot of people, myself included, and I'll plead guilty on this, thought that there was very little chance of that Fight for 15 movement making any progress. And we were wrong. It has made clear progress across the country, and that is almost entirely because of labor organizing. At the same time, unions have been battered in much of the country. They've been battered because of government policy, in significant part, often at the state and local level, state level. But I also think that it's just simply not true to say that is the reason that we've lost as many millions of manufacturing jobs as we have. We've lost 4.5 million. Manufacturing jobs since NAFTA came into effect, although, again, a lot of that is really probably because of Chinese competition. If you were to somehow, put card check into place, and you were to have a very pro-union administration, and you were even to impose the kind of tariffs that Donald Trump is talking about, and you were to bring back a lot of manufacturing in this country, you would not bring back those manufacturing jobs in the same way. You would get a lot of very automated factories. If you walk through a factory these days in almost any part of this country, you will see these sort of gleaming machines and very, very few workers. And that's just the reality that we live in now. And so if we're going to figure out how to improve the prospects of working Americans, it's going to have to be in some way outside of sort of traditional manufacturing, because it's just not going to be the same kind of scale that it once was.
And is it going to be you talked about local regulations sometimes being more onerous than federal. When we look at a fair wage, when we look at $15 an hour, a lot of this has been done on city level all over the country. Do you imagine that we're entering a time when where a lot of progressive things will be happening, that it won't be happening on a national level?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely going to see a lot of sort of the progressive policy experiments taking place at the local level, at the state level. We're seeing, governors like Jerry Brown in California and mayors like Bill de Blasio in New York who are sort of standing up and saying, we're going to fight back on this. I think those of us who are interested in kind of the nitty-gritty pieces of policy are going to be interested to see to what extent state and local governments are able to kind of keep pushing forward those progressive policies and see whether they work in much the same way that we've seen conservative-run states sort of carry out their own policy experiments even during the Obama years. Sort of most famously, Kansas has been kind of running an experiment in sort of very conservative governance over the last several years. And that's something that, economists are going to be paying a lot of attention to, whether or not that's a sort of good way to run a federal government is another question.
Scott in La Crosse. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Just very briefly, I wanted to respond to your guest's earlier comment about a lot of service work the stuff that people do here, like you mentioned, engineering, and that then having impact overseas and being a very well-paid job. But my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a country like India is looking very seriously. They don't want to just be the call centers for America's corporations. They want to be those people doing those engineering jobs and running that back this way. And for example, I mean the perfect example of this that comes to my mind would be like a radiologist. If you need an X-ray read, that X-ray mm-hmm. doesn't need to be read in the hospital you're visiting. It could very well be read overseas. So I'm not saying that those aren't good jobs right now that some of our service sector are doing. But down the line, it seems to me that exactly what had happened to all those manufacturing jobs might very well be coming towards the high-end service sector as well. Do you not think?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And I think, we've seen the automation of the manufacturing sector has kind of to some extent run its course. And what we're now seeing is automation and outsourcing coming to the service sector. I think one of the most disturbing trends over the last couple of decades has been a really steady decline in American entrepreneurship and the rate at which Americans start companies, which is something that is surprising to a lot of people because we hear about, you know, the Facebooks and the Ubers and disruption out of Silicon Valley. But if you sort of look at the numbers, we're starting fewer companies. Well, it's those entrepreneurial ventures that create jobs, that create whole new industries that grow up and you know, create new opportunities. And, you know, maybe those jobs get outsourced 20 years down the line, but you've got, you know, a good career ahead of you before that happens. If we're not creating new companies and new industries and thinking of new ways to do things, then you do run the risk of this sort of steady trickle of jobs out of the country with nothing to replace them. And, I think we have seen that to some degree, and that's something that you know, really we should be worried about.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Ben Castleman. And Ben writes for 538. He writes a very interesting, constantly informing us about what's going on in the economy. It is part of In Real Terms, which is a regular column analyzing the latest economic news. We're looking at manufacturing jobs that have left the country, how Donald Trump handled the carrier situation, keeping some jobs here in the United States, what replaces high-paying manufacturing jobs, what we can learn from how he carried out the carrier situation, what we can learn about how he might deal with these kinds of issues of jobs leaving the country. So we're talking to Ben about that this hour, and he's a senior editor and chief economics writer for 538. He's also an adjunct lecturer at the City University of New York and was previously a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to this face or email comment from Ann in Green Bay. I wonder if we have numbers on how many union employees voted against their interests in states like Wisconsin by voting for governors and legislators that have destroyed our union protections. Many of these workers who want to bring back manufacturing would not work for the manufacturers that Trump and conservatives would unleash. These will not be union jobs. The electorate is having a tantrum over demons they invited in the moment that they voted against the interests of labor on the state level. What do you say?
I haven't seen hard numbers on that. There were some exit polls that suggested, and I'm a few weeks out of date on looking at these now, but they certainly showed a shift in union support away from Democrats and towards Trump this year, certainly in stark contrast to in the past. I think that, you know, Democrats have to look seriously at themselves on this a little bit. It may well be that people voted against their interests. I think it's always a little bit dangerous to accuse people of that because they take a lot of different factors into account when they cast their votes. But, you know, Democrats, especially at the presidential level, embraced free trade policy dating back to Bill Clinton. They've sort of talked a lot about needing to find ways to make trade work for regular workers, but they've not always succeeded in carrying through on those promises, in some cases because they've been blocked in Congress, but they haven't necessarily focused on talking about those issues. And I think, you know, we've seen that in the aftermath of the election, is sort of, you know, some soul searching by Democrats kind of saying, how do we emphasize these issues more, and how do we, to some extent, get the message out about the work that they've already been doing in those areas?
Scott, thank you for your call. I forgot to thank you. Let's go next to Martin in West Middleton. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask your speaker real quick what his thoughts were on the FDA's recent enactment of their deeming regulation over tobacco products. Back in 2009, when Congress passed the S-CHIP regulation, they gave the FDA the regulatory authority to expand their authority whenever they saw fit. And the FDA is now targeting cigars, e-cigarettes, hookahs, and every other tobacco product that's not a cigar. And I've already seen this regulation put four companies that I've dealt with out of business. And these are small mom-and-pop shops. Cigar stores are owned by you and me, little people. These aren't big companies. So I was wondering what his thoughts were, and one last comment, talking about onerous regulations, the fees that are being imposed with this are six-figure fees. It's costing $300,000 approximately to enter a new product into the market. You can't show me any other field where you're faced with that kind of fee. So I'm interested to hear what your speaker says, and I'll take my answer.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can't speak to the details of that regulation. It's not something I know in any detail. I think there are two separate questions here, right? There's what is the actual impact of a regulation on jobs and on employers, and then there's what are the benefits of that regulation. You know, sometimes the costs are overblown. It's in every company's best interest to, especially if they're a publicly traded company with investors, right? They like to rail against regulation rather than saying, you know, well, we maybe didn't make a product that people wanted this quarter. But sometimes the costs are real. And then the question is, are the costs outweighed by the benefits? Is it worth cracking down on coal to hold back global warming, or are you too concerned about the impact on jobs? You know, are regulations about tobacco worth it because of the health benefits that those regulations bring, or are the costs too high? And that's a question that policymakers and obviously ultimately voters have to weigh. What I'd like to see is sort of real discussion of those costs and benefits rather than sort of, you know, blowing either one out of proportion, as sometimes happens.
Gary and Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hi. A little plug for Weinbrenner Shoes in Merrill and their affiliate Thoroughgood Shoes in Marshfield. As I understand it, they're doing quite well and they're shipping worldwide. A lot of countries always wanted made in the USA. I think it was politicians, both sides, along with the multinational corporations that decided to devastate the middle class. And there's no import taxes like other countries impose on us, and we're a first-world country. We should be paying first-world prices and make the product here in the United States.
Thank you, Gary. Ben.
I mean, I think one of the great misconceptions, the caller does a nice job of piercing here, is that we don't make anything in this country anymore, right? We make a tremendous amount in this country. On a value basis, we make as much in the U.S. as we ever have. We just make it with a lot fewer people. And some of that is because we sent a lot of the most labor-intensive jobs over industries overseas, and some of that is because we've found ways to make formerly labor-intensive products in much less labor-intensive ways. But, you know, we make lots of goods in the U.S. We make lots of, you know, big things, and we make lots of small things, and we sell them all over the world. To some extent, that's why it's going to be so hard to bring back manufacturing jobs, because it's not as simple as saying, oh, we don't make anything here anymore. If only we made things here. We do make things here. We just don't make them with as many people, and that's come at a real cost.
Mm. Let's go back to this, what jobs are going to replace those manufacturing jobs. We've heard waves of ideas over the past some years. Well, renewable energy. We're going to see a huge increase in research and development for getting us off fossil fuels. Now with the incoming administration, it would appear that we're going to be going in a different direction. Can you think of industries that really are going to give us something that we've never had before, and there's going to be a great explosion of jobs in that area?
Well, I mean, so one thing I think is worth saying is that we've never been any good at seeing those industries from around the corner, right? You know, we didn't see the internet coming. We didn't see the sort of first computer revolution coming. We didn't see, the industrial revolution coming, right? And so there's a long history of us sort of thinking that we're at the end of the road and then discovering new things. When the internet first came along, it wasn't creating many jobs, and people sort of said, oh, we've got this amazing new toy, but it doesn't do anything. And we've since seen that it's created all sorts of jobs, all sorts of industries that we never imagined existed. So I think sort of one answer to the question is no, we don't know what's going to happen. But if it follows past practice, then something will. There's a serious strain of thought, though, that challenges that and that says, you know, that we have seen sort of so much advancement in automation and artificial intelligence that even things that seemed very, very safe until recently are no longer safe. And that even if we create some new jobs, you know, this is, I think, a point that the an earlier caller made, things that seem like they're safe, you know, very quickly become unsafe. And so where before maybe you could have a whole career before your job started to be at risk, now, you know, you're in it for 5 years, you're in it for 10 years, and then all of a sudden that gets automated or outsourced too. And so I think one thing we have to think a lot about is how we design an education system in a way that ensures that people don't only learn the skills needed to get hired tomorrow, but they learn the kind of skills that let them then evolve and adapt in a profession as it changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just finding a job tomorrow is one thing, but if you know that skill becomes outmoded within a few years and you're right back to needing to get a new
right.
certificate or a new degree, you know, we're going to have real problems. And so thinking about how we design that educational system for the realities of a very fast-changing world is really important.
Ben, thank you so much. What an informative hour it was. Ben Castleman, Senior Editor, Chief Economics Writer for 538. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for doing on-air production here. And thank you very much for all of your calls and your interest in the subject. We'll return.